Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. Divisions are growing between the U.S. and its allies over Washington's decision to supply Ukraine with internationally banned cluster munitions. The British state broadcaster, the BBC, is under fire over mishandling an investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct by one of its presenters. And Sudan's health ministry says at least 22 people are killed and many wounded in an army airstrike on the city of Omdurman near the capital, Khartoum. More welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The United Kingdom says it will not provide internationally banned cluster munitions to Ukraine in its war with Russia.
Well, the UK is signatory to a convention which prohibits the production or use of cluster munitions and discourages their use. We will continue to do our part to support Ukraine against Russia's illegal and unprovoked invasion.
Sunak made the comments in an address to reporters. Spain has also followed suit, saying that certain weapons and bombs cannot be delivered under any circumstances. Germany and Canada have opposed sending cluster munitions to Ukraine as well. On Friday, the U.S. said that it will send Ukraine the widely banned weapons to help in its counteroffensive against Russia. It says that Kiev has provided written assurances that the weapons will be used carefully to minimize any risk to civilians. Russia has slammed Washington's move, saying that the decision is an act of desperation which displays weakness. Cluster munitions are banned by over 100 countries.
Cluster bombs, which the administration of United States President Joe Biden recently classified as a war crime, will now be sent to Ukraine in Washington's latest escalation of the unrest. Cluster munitions are banned by over half the world because they release dozens of bomblets, which often remain unexploded for decades after a conflict has ended. They cause more casualties among civilians than among combatants, and the United States is sending bombs with the imprecise grenades used in the 1991 invasion of Iraq. From bombing irrigation dams in Korea to Agent Orange in Vietnam to using chemical weapons against Iranians, the United States and their Western partners continue to use tactics which the global majority often finds immoral, even during wartime.
These are omnicide weapons. They're the worst atrocities in history, each in a can. Do reduce any sense of our moral authority in this war, since we're not in this to protect civilians. We're not in this to protect Ukrainians, who we've maneuvered into being our foot soldiers and into dying for American interests while America doesn't sit comfortably at home.
With diplomacy off the table and Kiev's long-awaited counteroffensive a failure, Washington admitted that they are sending the bombs because they are running out of traditional ammunition.
Because of the dramatically high expenditure rates of artillery by Ukraine and by Russia, where we need to build a bridge from where we are today to when we have enough monthly production of unitary rounds. This is the moment to begin the construction of that bridge so that there isn't any period over this summer or heading into this fall when Ukraine is short on artillery.
Escalation is reaching such levels that some analysts in Russia are actually advocating the use of nuclear weapons against Western Europe as the only way to restore the fear of war among Western leaders and to finally end the 9-year conflict in Ukraine. The United States used similar logic against Japan in World War II.
Our government says that stresses that Russia has been using cluster bombs through the war. Russian President Putin is, if anything, unpopular in his country to the extent that he's the most popular politician there. But he gets grief for having gone into Ukraine too soft in an attempt not to kill the civilians that ultimately this civil war has been about. It's been a pogrom by Kyiv and by, I think, Ukrainians in the west of the country against its east.
NATO members will meet next week in Lithuania, where many fear an even more significant expansion of the war will be announced. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Security forces have clashed with protesters in France's capital, Paris. They took to the streets to rally against police brutality despite a ban on demonstrations. The rally was called by the family of Adama Traoré, a black Frenchman who died in police custody in 2016. Police arrested Adama's brother and several other protesters. French police banned demonstrations on Saturday over risks to public order, citing a, quote, context of tensions. Protesters described the ban as unacceptable. They called for an end to institutional racism in the country. Rallies have been held since late June when a police officer fatally shot 17-year-old Nahel Merzouk at a traffic stop in a Parisian suburb. Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin says more than 3,600 people, mostly teenagers, have been arrested. Political analyst Mustafa Traoré says that the French government has proven that it is not willing to fight racism and that the UN needs to step in.
Racism is something very obvious in France. We've been saying it for years, but it seems that the authorities do not want to listen to those who suffer from racism. And the reason why is because we live in a very racist society, a society that built itself through slavery, through colonization, through the exploitation of other people, and they do not want to change the system. We need the intervention of the UN. Otherwise, nothing is going to change. Otherwise, not, because the will to change things is not there in France. So it is that the UN has to put more pressure. And we've got to think if an independent organization should not be asked to do the job to control the French police, because we have reached a stage where people is clearly being killed. Okay, so to the point that when you have kids of African backgrounds, you're very scared. Now, you, when they get to a certain age, you have to explain them things, okay? You know, if normal kids do this, you won't be able to do that, okay? You have, because you are seen in this society differently. And I think this is not a normal thing. This is not how things should be.
The British state broadcaster, the BBC, is under fire over the mishandling of an investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct by one of its presenters. The presenter, not identified publicly, is accused of paying more than £35,000 to a teenage drug addict for explicit pictures and videos over a span of 3 years. Well, critics are now saying the corporation had taken a very long time to investigate the allegations. The BBC was allegedly first made aware of the claims in May. The recipient's mother says she had to beg the BBC to stop the man after making a complaint. Defund the BBC, a campaign group, says the row shows that the broadcaster has not been able to police itself and instead chose to whitewash. A former British Home Secretary says the BBC has become a faceless and unaccountable organization. Sudan's health ministry says at least 22 people are killed and many wounded in an army airstrike on the city of Omdurman near the capital Khartoum. The paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF, has put the death toll at 31. Saying the attack also caused significant damage to homes. However, the army said special forces had killed rebel soldiers and destroyed their weaponry. The power struggle between the army and the RSF began in mid-April. Thousands of people have been killed ever since. The conflict has also caused a humanitarian crisis, displacing over 2.5 million Sudanese. Several ceasefire attempts have failed to stop the infighting. The Islamic movement in Nigeria has staged a peaceful protest to condemn the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. Danjuma Abdullahi has the details from Abuja.
Just after the Friday prayers at the National Mosque in Abuja, the demonstrators raised placards condemning the desecration of the Quran in Sweden. The protesters later marched on the streets, raising the Quran in solidarity with Muslims around the world. They later stopped for a rally and called on all Muslims and people with moral sense to condemn the deliberate act. The demonstrators have condemned in strong terms the sacrilege under the guise of freedom of expression. They said it is unacceptable to insult Muslims by desecration of the Holy Quran.
We are condemning this atrocity because this is trampling upon our rights as Muslims. Attacking or burning the Holy Quran is as burning all the Muslims or even humanity in general, because you must respect what people respect. So we are condemning what happened in Sweden. By so doing, we are protesting so that such a thing should not happen elsewhere again.
The most significant part of the rally was the burning of the Swedish flag in condemnation of the provocative act. The demonstrators accused the Swedish government, the Europeans, and the United States of complicity in the plot to insult and provoke Muslims around the world.
You don't fight ideologies with a barbaric act. The affair is the growth of Islam. If you look at the global trend, recent survey shows that the most popular name in the world is Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I look at the trend of Islam and Muslims in Europe. Definitely they are worried, and they have every reason to be worried. But it is the era of Islam.
Sweden has an infamous history of Islamophobic acts, and over the years, Muslims have been the target of violence simply because of their religion there. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
The UN has refused to retract its condemnation of Israel over the deadly military incursion into the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. UN Deputy Spokesperson Farhan Haq says the Secretary General stands by his criticism of Israel. At least 12 Palestinians were killed and over 100 injured in Israel's large-scale ground and air offensive, which also destroyed homes and infrastructure, displacing thousands. Antonio Guterres strongly condemned the acts of violence against civilians. He also criticized Israel for using excessive force, as well as preventing the injured from receiving medical care and humanitarian workers from reaching everyone in need. This angered the Israeli regime, which called the UN chief's remarks shameful, far-fetched, and completely detached from reality. Iran says that Israel has experienced a new historic defeat in its recent brutal attack on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the raid was a blatant violation of international law and amounts to war crimes. He said the bigger defeat is for the supporters of the Tel Aviv regime. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said devastation left behind in Jenin is a shameful moral failure for them. Kanani called on Palestinian authorities to show the world the destructions in the city so that the self-proclaimed advocates of human rights are even more disgraced. Moving on, voters head to the polls in Uzbekistan in an election that is expected to hand President Shavkat Mirziyoyev a third term in office. Mirziyoyev, who has been in power since the year 2016, is running against three little-known candidates in the presidential ballot. This means that he is almost certain to come out the winner. His campaign is focused on the economy and education, with a pledge to double Uzbekistan's GDP to $160 billion. His new presidential bid comes after recent constitutional reforms that removed the two-term limit on presidency. The reforms mean that he can remain in office until the year 2037. The number of people killed from the partial collapse of a building in northeastern Brazil has risen to 14. Officials say rescue workers concluded a search for survivors from the rubble after the three-story structure collapsed in the city of Paulista on Friday. A total of 11 dead was announced earlier. The dead included men, women, and children aged 5 to 45. Local authorities say the building had been closed in 2010 due to risk of collapse, but had been illegally occupied since then. In April, a building in similar conditions collapsed in the same region, leaving 6 people dead. Building collapses in Brazil generally happen in poor neighborhoods where illegal construction is rampant. South Koreans have hit the streets of the capital Seoul to protest against Japan's plan to release contaminated water from the Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean. The IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, has traveled to the South Korean capital to reassure officials and opposition there that the water release will not harm humans or the environment. Our correspondent Frank Smith has more.
South Korean environmental activists and their supporters from dozens of NGOs across the country gathered in the center of Seoul on Sunday to protest against Japan's plan to release the nuclear-contaminated water from the Fukushima power plant. Protesters argued that the release violates international law and that its effects are unknown. This week, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, toured the site during his visit to Japan before heading to South Korea. Grossi's report said the planned release of the treated wastewater would have a, quote, negligible radiological impact on people and the environment and meets international standards. But Grossi and the IAEA did not endorse Japan's plan or accept responsibility for any potential negative consequences.
The IAEA has sided with the Japanese government throughout the report, but is crucially avoiding their responsibilities by showing a dual attitude. I think the IAEA has failed to fulfill its responsibilities as an international organization.
South Korea's opposition has slammed President Yoon Suk-yeol over his government's support of the plan, arguing that Yoon seeks to gain diplomatic favor with Tokyo in order to strengthen the country's alliance with the United States.
Demonstrations like this one against Japan's plan to release the nuclear-contaminated water from the Fukushima plant into the Pacific Ocean have grown larger as the date to begin the discharge approaches. 80% of the South Korean public oppose the move. Still, the dumping is scheduled to begin within weeks and last for decades. Frank Smith, Seoul.
An energy exhibition is underway in the Syrian capital, Damascus, with the aim of creating opportunities in this sector, which has been under the West sanctions for years. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali has more.
An exhibition on energy, gas, and petroleum opened its doors in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Syria's Minister of Oil, alongside Iran's ambassador to Syria, toured the venue and got briefed on the latest technologies in this sector. The Syrian official stated that Syria plans to increase oil production.
We have very good technologies in the oil, gas and petrochemical sector. Unfortunately, in Syria, areas rich in oil and gas are under U.S. occupation. The electricity production in Syria is also facing problems as power generation stations require fuel. We are aiming to assist Syria in the petrochemical field.
There are 55 local and regional companies participating in the four-day event from countries like Russia, Algeria, Iraq, and Iran, which has the largest number of non-Syrian companies in the exhibition. They said they aim to explore partnerships and assist Syria in developing its oil industry, which was heavily affected by the war in Syria.
We are involved in producing corrosion-resistant products of the composite type for the oil and gas industry in Iran. The Americans, they don't like to see the two countries help each other. But to me, this is an excellent way of both countries to evade sanctions.
Right now, our goal is to promote or providing the advanced technology for all companies. No matter where they're from, as long as you're in Syria, we provide service for oil and gas search for long term.
According to Syria's oil ministry, the oil and gas sector in Syria has sustained nearly $100 billion as Western countries continue to impose unjust sanctions on the Arab country. Natural resources used to be one of the main sources of income for Syria until the U.S. occupied most oil-rich areas during the war. And in a world where double standards are common, only few countries like Iran and Russia offer help to Syria by discussing partnerships and solutions at such events. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday of summer, July 9th, 2023. I'm Atefa Erfani, hosting this program today, and heartiest felicitations to you all on the occasion of an auspicious day. Today, the 20th of Dhul Hijjah, according to a narration, happens to be the birth anniversary of Imam Musa Kazem, the seventh infallible successor of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program where your views are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our programs. Tell us your views about our broadcast. Tell us which program or programs you like the most. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. As I always say, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back, everyone. This is Listeners Special, and here we've received reception reports from around the world, from Ronnie Hussein from Bangladesh, from Kalul Nat from India, and from Krister Bronstorm from Sweden. So, Ronnie, Kalul, and Krister, thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And let's see who has sent us email or letter from around the world. Yes, Najmuddin, one of our old and regular listeners from India, has sent us a piece of email. Here we have a piece of email from Japan, from Hitoshi Sugio, one of our regular listeners. Again from India, we have an email from Ram Babukumar. From Italy, we have an email from Gianluca Dentici. And again from India, we have an email from Hasna Manzil. Stay with us, please. After a short break, I will be back with you to read these emails. Welcome back. So, Najmuddin from India, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us a writing, a piece of email. Najmuddin says, Assalamu alaikum. For the past 2 decades, anti-Islamic extremist groups have been making the holy religion of Islam their hateful target. Sometimes by insulting the great prophet of Islam, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, under the guise of freedom of speech. Sometimes by burning the holy book of God, Quran, the latest of which happened recently in Sweden. It is high time to take united action against such atrocity. I strongly condemn this heinous crime and call on all Muslim heads of state in the world to sever all ties with the Swedish government so that this reprehensible incident does not happen again. Salam Najmuddin, and thank you for your comments about the recent developments that happened in Sweden. Of course, all Muslims and all faithfuls of holy books and followers of holy books and all justice-seeking people around the world condemn this sacrilegious behavior and heinous crime. And we also wish that this incident won't happen again in the future, because this heinous crime has angered almost everyone in the world. And of course, it shouldn't happen again. We are so appreciative for your views, Najmuddin. Thank you very much for your concern about this issue, for this heinous crime. We also condemn this incident. Anyway, Najmuddin from India, write us soon and please accept our electronic QSL as confirmation to your email. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And from Japan, we've received an email from Hitoshi Sogyo, one of our regular listeners. Hitoshi says, Dear staff, my name is Hitoshi Sogyo. I am 51 years old and I work in municipality here in Hyogo, Japan. I have received your program and I would like to give you a report. I listen to your English program at home. If you confirm the details of my report is correct, I request you to send me your verification card or letter to my address in Japan or by email. Thank you in advance. Salam and warm greetings from Tehran and warm gratitude to you for letting us know your views about IRIB English Radio. And I wish you could tell us the title of the program you listened to recently. And, of course, your opinion about our programs is always welcomed. Hitoshi Sogyo from Japan, please accept our electronic QSL as verification. You can also refer to our website at parstoday.ir/en, and there you can find our frequency schedule. Anyway, we wish you luck and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, Hitoshi Sugio from Japan. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. One of our listeners from Italy, Gianluca Dentici, has sent us a piece of email. Gianluca Dentici says, Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, I love both paper cards and e-cards. Anything is always welcome. And I hope to receive one of those eye-catching QSL cards of you, hopefully. Obviously, I will write you back as soon as I get your signals again. Salam from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, to Gianluca Dentici from Italy. Ciao. Appreciations to you for this writing, and thank you for your support for IRIB English Radio. Please accept our electronic QSL or EQSL as confirmation to your email. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our broadcast. Gianluca Dentici from Italy. Thank you for this email. from India, we've received an email from Ram Babu Kumar. Ram Babu Kumar, as you may know, is one of our regular listeners. Ram Babu Kumar says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, greetings from India. I want to say that please add our club name in your mailing list and send us all types of materials issued by your radio time to time on our postal address. The useful information about your programs schedule and frequencies is also welcomed. Salam to you, Ram Babu Kumar from India. Greetings from Tehran and from IRIB English Radio staff, and thank you very much for writing to us. Please accept our electronic QSL as confirmation to your email. You can also refer to our website at parstoday.ir/en to find the frequency schedule. Ram Babu Kumar from India, we wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And after a short break, I will be back with you again. Welcome back again from India. We have another email from Hasna Manzil. Hasna Manzil is one of our regular listeners who says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, I am a listener of World Radios and this time I had a chance to listen to IRIB English service. I would love to listen to your radio regularly too, so please send me the frequency guide of your station with complete details of the programs. I shall be very grateful if you do it. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran. Hasna Manzil from India, thank you very much for this writing. Please accept our electronic QSL as a verification to this email and thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And as you may know, because sending any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio at the time is not possible, please refer to our website at parstoday.ir/en and there you can find the frequency guide of IRIB English Radio with complete details of the programs. We are so grateful for this email, Hasna Manzil from India. And here we come to the end of our today's listeners special. But before saying goodbye, I want to send my warm greetings, appreciations and gratitudes to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world, including Roni Hossein from Bangladesh, Kalol Kath from India, Krister Bronstorm from Sweden, Gianluca Dentici from Italy, Ram Babu Kumar from India, Najmuddin from India, Hitoshi Sugio from Japan, and Hasna Manzil from India. We had a great time being together with you. Please keep in touch with Listeners Special and IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Dozens of marches against police violence in France have kicked off after authorities banned a memorial rally for Adama Traoré. He's a young black man who died in police custody 7 years ago, with clashes reported in Paris in which his brother was actually arrested rather violently. This on top of the shock announcement that the country's police forces may be allowed to spy on suspects by remotely activating their camera, microphone, and GPS of their phones and other devices. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether France is going through a social crisis, or is it going through a democracy crisis? Or is it on the cusp of a major uprising with police violence against people of color being the spark? First, let me introduce our guests. Matthew Everett, senior fellow at the American University in Moscow, joins us from Montreal. Also joining us, John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Over to our guests in Montreal first. Looking at Matthew Everett, a simple question that I'm going to start this program with. Is there systemic racism by French security forces?
Though the answer is a lot more complex and nuanced, yes, I think there actually is systemic racism in the case of France and in the case of many of the Western colonial societies that have a lot of unresolved baggage that has never been properly dealt with in their past, which in some ways that karma is coming up to bite a lot of current people within the French establishment. We see it all over the transatlantic. But yes, to answer your question, there is.
Okay. Taking into account the fact that you had 5 days of violence that occurred in many French cities, police violence was exercised against many French. And interestingly enough, in this video, the person who got arrested was the brother of Adam Traoré, who's that young black man who died in police custody 7 years ago. So when you see that, what are your thoughts in terms of police violence, again, coming off the heels of these 5 days of protests?
Well, I have to say that this is a very, very personal topic for myself. This, what's happening in Paris, is not, of course, confined only to France. This is there's a worldwide number of experiences of police violence. We've heard of the George Floyd case in the United States. And I myself left my native country of Canada after I testified in 1987 against two police who almost killed a man in front of me in Montreal, where I was studying, where your other guest tonight is speaking to us from. I had to leave Canada because I testified against the police and they were convicted and went to jail. That was my case. I can tell you this case is far worse. This man was killed, and now we have another man killed in these riots in France. And what the tragedy was compounded by the fact in France that no one was convicted of any crime in the case of Adama Traoré. No one was convicted even of brutality, let alone of murder. And these kinds of flashpoints prove that the police, at least the minority of violent and out-of-control police, are abusing their power and threatening the system more so than peaceful demonstrators. And these marches in memory of Adama Traoré in France have been conducted since 2016, when he was killed, until this year, 7 years with no violence whatsoever. And the government's intervention to lock down and ban these demonstrations today is indicative of the government's fear of their own people.
You know, when you have the UN weigh in on this, in particular the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, there, Matthew Ayrhit, they have asked France to actually pass legislation that defines bans racial profiling. They've requested that from France. And the other area that is interesting is what I believe it hits it in the right on the spot is how they said they were concerned by the persistent practice of racial profiling combined with excessive use of force in the application of law, in particular by the police, against members of minority groups, notably people of African and Arab origin. Do you think the UN is defining this problem in a major way?
Well, I think it's always a bit of a danger to fall into certain myopic trappings of the sort of game that is being played in some sense, because there are always the issue of foreign intelligence agencies, mass manipulation, and other things that try to focus the debate, the acceptable narrative, and disputes around very controlled, factionalized discussions around the debate, whether it's uncontrolled immigration that are stealing our jobs and wrecking, making our lives worse economically, or is it going to be just the reactionary conservative hand coming down violently, which in both cases there's elements of truth but also lies, because what's often being missed out, including from the UN in the discussion, is the matter of why did we bomb Libya? Why did France participate in so many regime change wars that have made the lives of people unlivable in North Africa and around Africa more generally, where France-Afrique has conducted an exploitative regime for decades and decades, if not centuries, which again has created a situation of ungovernability both in those countries but also in France and much of Europe itself. And again, a lot of these discussions are too myopic for my tastes, and there are always involvements, like I've seen increasing evidence of various types of agents provocateurs who have been infused into the mix, as we've seen with many color revolutionary tactics all around the world. Even, you know, many white people, black, you know, dressed up in sort of like an Antifa type of militarist gear, conducting some of the worst acts of vandalism, even car bombs. There's evidence of weapons that seem to have been coming in from even Ukraine, flooding into the mob situation in France. So there's a bit of a controlled chaos that I think is bubbling up right now that is being influenced by forces that are not particularly involved with or representative of the people protesting or the authorities themselves. There's other factors, as seems to be the case.
Well, that's interesting. That puts another angle to this whole thing. Where do you think, what are the outside factors? Who would you attribute it to?
Well, I think that you have to look at the Anglo-American establishment, which has been very unhappy with some of the actions that have been taken by Macron. Who, but don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of Macron, but Alex Craner, an analyst, has done some very good analysis on this, pointing out that Macron's recent trip from China, where he called just a few months ago for Europe not to be satraps of the United States foreign policy and came out with business deals involved with buying 64,000 metric tons of natural gas in Chinese yuan. He's made a request for France to be an involved member in the upcoming BRICS summit in South Africa, and even called NATO brain dead. He's made a point that, you know, Ukraine is just some far-off country. So the French elite, I think, recognized that they are rather disposable in a broader geopolitical gambit against Russia and China as the actual targets. And I think that France, there's sort of a bit of a faction fight amongst the elites between the French and the Anglo-American establishment.
Okay. Well, interesting. John Busnich, looking at the government response to this, in particular some government officials, there seems to be, if not there is, a disconnect. For example, when you take a look at what has been said in particular by, let me see, I have some sound bites here. Let's look at President Emmanuel Macron, the man at the top, who has denied institutional racism within the country's law enforcement agencies. Or you have the government spokesman who said the convening of demos in major cities that have not yet recovered from the rampages should not be done right now. Or you have another minister who said any ethnic profiling by law enforcement is banned in France. This is a ministry that has said that, adding the struggle against excess and racial profiling has intensified. In particular, when it comes to the French president, I guess, how could he come out and make a statement like that, that, you know, there is no racist police violence happening in his country?
Well, first of all, that's the job of the president in that system, to justify the system. That's what the president of France does. If there is a racial profiling, he's certainly not going to admit it unless a commission is formed and proves it. For the president of France to admit that there's racial profiling in such a multi-ethnic city as Paris in particular would be a carte blanche for all kinds of uprisings and further violence. So Macron is in a tough place. Macron is coming from a bit, what is basically a right-of-center party, and he is trying to walk a narrow line between calming the demonstrators and at the same time protecting the system by denying what is evidently visible to many observers. Macron is also in a tough place on the international level, and this disruption in his home territory is limiting his ability to make any kind of impact with respect to the conflict in Ukraine and international affairs. So I would say that Macron is in a very unstable position, and he is trying to survive this summer. As we know, the French have rebellions and have revolutions in the summer. The storming of the Bastille was on the 14th of July. We're just days away from that. The anniversary, the day of the death of Adama Traoré was the 19th of July, and the march was held today, even though the police banned the march. France is on the cusp of what could turn into a real deposing of the president through public activity. The question is whether he is going to be able to control the police, because in many instances, the police in France have been far more harsh than their elected officials.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So taking a look at the way that the police has handled this, I mean, we have to cover this, Matthew. I heard. Are we looking at the fact that they've been giving too much power? Are we looking at them being told that they need to enforce the law in a harsh way when it comes to the protest? Or are we looking at other factors that are involved behind the behavior, which many have called excessive violence used on the protesters?
Well, there definitely is excessive, a lot of evidence of excessive reactions by many of the police in trying to put down the protest. It's difficult to say because it's such a complex moving piece with many, many parts to it. And again, it's somewhat difficult to say exactly. I don't know how to answer that question exactly.
Okay.
What I could say is the following. Look, the French police have been, there's a lacking of leadership. There's lack of ability to just put some context and to communicate with the people, to own up to the sins of the past and the present, which would be very needed to begin to actually deal with the underlying rage and anger and sense of injustice in the masses. That's just not there right now. As the previous speaker just pointed out, there's been an effort to just ignore the reality and the pain that people are feeling. And at the same time, there's a bit of a two-facedness too, right? Where the previous protests that have really gripped France, the Yellow Vest movement, was ignored by the media or slandered as being radical right-wingers. But this particular protest now is being covered by the New York Times, being given a lot of focus because I think there are more political, geopolitical agendas that wish to destabilize France more than anything. And I think France, both the elites as well as the police officers, are falling into the trap by not by playing the game.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, we need to maybe change the direction of this program as to maybe cover some of the things that you are finding maybe hard to decipher here. Hopefully we'll get to that with a little bit of time that we got left. All right, so John Busnich, you know, taking a look at some of the things that have happened throughout the decades when it comes to France, it's no surprise to many what is happening right now because it seems like this has been something that has been passed on year after year, decade after decade, where the French overall, one administration after the other, has ignored the racist police violence. I mean, not only just the French government, you're talking about politicians, and just not Macron, that have denied institutional racism within the country. They don't believe it exists. But these are things that have bubbled under the surface. Where do you think the source of the problem is? Are we looking at the fact that there are certain areas in France in which the people who live in this underprivileged areas filled with migrants or people of color with African descent are not given the right economic opportunities like maybe the rest of the country has? What do you think?
That's of course correct. But I can tell you that there are entire districts in Paris which are considered at nighttime to be no-go zones. The police themselves hesitate to enter into those areas. And I think what one thing we haven't mentioned so far in this discussion today is the revelation to many people who have never believed it, although those of us in government advisory positions have known it all along, is that the police have the capacity to listen to your phone calls, to track your location, to access your files on your phone, and to see what's seen through the camera of your phone, and that the French government has admitted this, has blown the cover on the entire question of personal privacy and government spying. And I think that we've got a possibility here that you will see the racial-based unrest and the legitimate protests against police violence combined with the outrage of the rest of the population over the fact that they now realize through a government admission that they are being spied upon and watched 24/7 at the whim of the state. This is too much for the French. The French people are a revolutionary, democratically oriented nation. And once they get these two sticks in their hands, if they rub them against each other, the friction is going to rise, the fires are going to rise, and there is a real threat of instability in France. And this is exactly what NATO and the United States least want when they've got a war that they're pushing in Ukraine at the same time. This is the worst combination possible for the Western military police spying alliance.
All right, so that eliminates two factors, if you agree with him, John Ehrhardt, of people that may be, or entities that may be involved in what you said was foreign hands at play, for lack of a better way of me putting it. Because I think that's the kind of line that you are maybe more inclined to discuss, if I'm correct to understand you, John Ehrhardt. Who's to gain from the unrest that's happening inside of France, and what would be their objectives?
Well, the issue of the broader Five Eyes and France being a sort of informal member of the Nine Eyes broader security apparatus, the dragnet that has been expanding its efforts since 1946, really, and growing in influence that interfaces with NATO. And I mean, there are unresolved issues like, you know, NATO's secret armies, the Operation Gladio operations that were used to conduct terrorist operations, both targeted assassinations as well as of nationalist leaders throughout the Cold War, as well as broader acts of terrorism in the 60s, 70s, 80s, that was always run by NATO, MI6, MI5, CIA operations. These are unresolved things that create an atmosphere, strategy of tension and terror to have the populations who don't understand what the hell is going on half the time fall more into the embrace of their captured governments, who would be increasingly under the control of the same unresolved, unreconstructed Nazis and fascists that worked with the CIA at MI6, that ran many of the Central and Eastern European operations of NATO itself. You know, these were never dissolved. They were never this never disappeared, and I think it just took on a new form after the Soviet Union collapsed. So we have this issue now where you have two different orientations for the future that are pulling us, one being a multipolar view that is more protective of the idea of the sovereign nation state and cooperation, the other one based upon the idea of you know, fulfilling this type of global feudal society under a controlled master-slave structure. Uh-huh. And you have a battle within France over what role France is going to play in that process.
All right. Last question that I'm going to ask here is the notion of democracy, John Busnish, which many French are now under the illusion that that's what is actually being lost here. It was very evident when you had Emmanuel Macron fast-track the legislation when it came to the retirement age being raised by a couple of years. And, of course, you mentioned the government admission in terms of the control that they have regarding their phones, regarding their cameras, et cetera, and also the fact that Emmanuel Macron was actually contemplating restriction of social media. Are we looking at democracy under threat in France?
Absolutely. You put your finger right on it. And I first want to underline that I support every word of our other guest here today. He's right on the mark. This is a crisis of credibility of not just France, but of the so-called Western democratic system. We have seen the curtain pulled back. We have seen that the Wizard of Oz is an evil wizard and that he is running the system. And these are the oligarchs, the military-industrial complex, and the innocent black victims on the street are one, just one of the many victims of the entire system. It's a snake's nest, and it's exposed to public view, and the public is not putting up with it. And the people of France are the kind of people who will stand up and bring down a government. This is the key touch point right now in the stability of the entire Western alliance, and it's in Paris, and it's at a really critical hot point today.
Thank you very much, John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst. And thank you for your input there, Matthew. I heard very interesting. Senior fellow at the American University in Moscow spoke to us from Montreal. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz.